Our next case for argument this morning is United States v. McMahon. Mr. Saltzman.
Good morning, judges. My name is Stephen Saltzman. I represent Antonio McMahon. I'll be arguing the issue regarding the bolstering of the wiretap evidence, and I'm also prepared to answer questions the court has on the issue concerning the admission of gang evidence and hearsay, the Bruton issue, and the denial of a motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence. In Cunningham, this court reversed and remanded for a new trial on the basis that it was apparent the Title III evidence was not relevant and that the procedures used in gaining wiretap approval were wholly irrelevant, were wholly unrelated to the defendant's guilt or innocence.
There was an objection to that testimony in Cunningham, though.
There was a hearsay and form of the question objection at some point in that testimony. Yes,
Judge. No objection here.
There was an objection at some point in the transcript, Judge, by two of the counsel, page 418 of the transcript. But here, Judge, this is worse than Cunningham, Judge, because here what we had is the government affirmatively moved to exclude this evidence as being irrelevant, and the court, in a motion in limine, and the court entered an order saying that the evidence, in fact, was irrelevant and was not permissible to be used. So on that basis, this was a definitively decided issue, that evidence about the wiretap, the legality of the wiretap, was not relevant, had no relevance to this case, and therefore it was a decided issue. And we rely on the Wilson versus Williams line of cases, Judge, where this court said that when an issue has been definitively decided, it does not need to be brought up again. And the court in that case specifically said, treating a definitive ruling as sufficient to preserve the litigant's position also avoids laying a trap for the unwary counselors. Instead of laying snares, we adopt an approach that tolerates human failings. The government, having moved to exclude this testimony, then aggressively introduced it with its first witness, Agent Horton, and he testified at length about these procedures. This issue had been definitively decided, and for that basis, we think we've preserved the harmless error standard. I would also note, Judge,
if there's a sufficient objection here, and you say there is, the other side says there isn't, but if there is, then you still run into a problem. Tell me why I'm wrong here. And given the big picture of all the evidence in this case, how that sort of detail about the Title III application would be prejudicial error.
The Title III, the phone calls were critical evidence, Judge.
Well, the phone calls were, but the procedure for getting the authorization.
Because the procedure, as this court said in Cunningham, is what bolsters that, is what gives that added credibility. And that was exactly, I don't think this case is any different from Cunningham on that point, Judge. And the government's very clear in its closing. The calls convict the defendants, it says in transcript page 3009 cited in our reply brief. So it's no different. That evidence helps set it up. That's why it's the first thing, virtually the first thing out of Agent Horton's mouth. Virtually the first questions from the government has to do with this whole litany of questions about the process for obtaining the wiretap, the need for probable cause, the need for approval in Washington, the need for the chief judge's approval, 10-day reports. The whole litany of that testimony goes to set up this wiretap evidence as the supreme evidence. And in fact, it's what the government relies on.
Well, I understand they rely on the evidence, and there's just oodles of wiretap conversations here that have been cited in the record. But I just wonder how, just in the big picture, if there is this improper bolstering, why it would necessarily be anything other than a harmless error case like this, assuming that there was even an objection.
For the same reason that it was in Cunningham, Judge. And here we have this very aggressive use of it. And I would note that with respect to some of the witnesses, D'Angelo McMahon is found not guilty. These witnesses are not believed in large measure.
Well, on the
conspiracy count. That's right, Judge. And I think that's important in terms of how significant the wiretap evidence was and why this bolstering of it is not only improper.
Question, counsel, is not whether the wiretap evidence is significant. That's obviously admissible. The problem in Cunningham, as I understand it, is the prosecutor shouldn't be able to say, you know, we had good grounds for suspecting these people, and here are our grounds for suspecting them. The trial has to be focused on what grounds do we have for thinking them guilty with admissible evidence. But I do. But this leads me to share Judge Evans's concern. Even if it was bad to show that the defendants were suspects, once we know what was in the wiretaps, it's awfully hard to see how what went before could be very important. Right? Is there any reason why it was important once we know what was in the wiretaps?
Yes, Judge, because it's more than just we had a reason to suspect. There's this imprimatur given. It's the imprimatur of the Justice Department in Washington.
You might as well say the defendants can't be indicted because that's the imprimatur of the Justice Department that we think they're guilty.
No, Judge, the jury specifically told that the indictment is not proof of anything. Here what we have
is... And the jury was told that in order to convict your clients... had to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt that they actually did it. Not that they were suspects, but that they did it.
That's true, Judge. But on that point, this case is no different than Cunningham. If anything, it's as I said, it's worse. The testimony's more specific. The government had said it wasn't going there and then aggressively chose to do so.
In response to my question and Judge Evans's, other than the claim that this somehow lends the imprimatur, because my question is a genuine one. It is, how can evidence that the defendants were suspects be harmful when we know from what the wiretap showed up, proved, that they in fact did it?
Well, Judge, it is because in a trial like this, evidence, the imprimatur helps make this evidence more significant.
My question is, do you have anything other than this imprimatur business?
No, Judge. I think this, in the same way that there was nothing else in the Cunningham case. Judge, I just want to add a couple of points on some other issues. First of all, I want to note that there on the Bruton issue that... there was a continuing objection made by me to the use of the post-arrest statements at pages 428 and 429 of the transcript. The government had raised a forfeiture issue there, and I wanted to be clear that had been made at an early stage and continued to be made. Judge, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Saltzman. Mr. Anderson.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, Thomas Anderson of Foley & Lardner on behalf of Brian Nelson. I'll be addressing first the Batson issue and then Mr. Nelson's sentencing issue. As the Court is aware, the Supreme Court and Batson articulated a three-part test or inquiry to ensure that people are not excluded from juries based on their race. As a threshold matter, I note that here we're only concerned with the second and third parts of that inquiry, specifically the government's purportedly race-neutral reasons and whether, in fact, they were race-neutral or whether they were pretextual. In this case, the defendants leveled a Batson challenge against the government's peremptory strike of Mr. Willie Pryor. Mr. Pryor was the only African-American on the first panel of 16 veneer persons that was examined. Upon raising the Batson objection, the district court asked the government to provide its race-neutral reasons for the strike, and the government provided purportedly two race-neutral reasons, the first of which was that Mr. Pryor lived on Chicago's west side, and the government explained that this was the most important of its two reasons, Mr. Pryor's residence on Chicago's west side, specifically in area code 60651, which was an area code that was, which was Mr. Pryor's area code, and the government, a government agent had apparently overheard some family or friends of the defendants in the gallery indicate that that was a quote-unquote good zip code, which the government indicated gave them concern that this might be in the locus, in the area of the locus of this conspiracy, which was at Washington and Waller. The second reportedly race-neutral given was that Mr. Pryor had friends who had been arrested. In accepting these two reasons, the district court erred, and I'll address the first one, that Mr. Pryor lives on Chicago's west side first, and I think that it is pretty clear that this court stated pretty clearly in the Briscoe case that rationale standing alone is not a race-neutral reason. It's a pretext. It's the court recognized in that case that the west side of Chicago is heavily populated by African Americans. Now, the government claims that they were attempting to narrow down Mr. Pryor's address, and their concern was that it was in the area of the locus of this conspiracy. But that claim is betrayed by the fact that once they had that zip code, the government never actually tracked it down. And so I also think that, you know, this isn't the sort of reasonably clear and specific reason related to the case to be tried that Batson calls for. And I also note that in the district court, both Ms. Schatz and Mr. Boyd specifically informed the district court that, in fact, the corner or intersection of Washington and Waller is not in zip code 60651. With respect to the second reason that Mr. Pryor had friends who had been arrested, the government's failure to strike Mr. Thompson reveals this to be pretext. Mr. Thompson had a brother who was incarcerated for actually cocaine use, which was one of the drugs that was specifically at issue in this trial. Mr. Pryor indicated that he had several friends who had been arrested for drugs, grand theft auto, or weapons charges, but there was never specific mention of any type of drug, even in his case. And you would think that if the government's, you know, rationale for striking Mr. Pryor, which was purportedly that he might sympathize with the jury on account of his having friends who had been arrested, if that were really the rationale, one would have thought Mr. Thompson would have been the first to go.
So you're arguing as if we were the district court, which we aren't. The question is whether the district court's finding of no racial motive was clearly erroneous.
I think
what makes the district court's finding clearly erroneous?
I think the reason it's clearly erroneous, Your Honor, is that there's this evidence in the record that shows that these reasons given by the government couldn't be anything but pretext.
Well, why, when you consider that the government did not exercise peremptory challenges against a number of African Americans who ended up on the jury, and the foreperson of the jury was African American? Well, the judge is looking at the whole picture here and rejecting, I think, essentially on credibility basis, that the removal of Mr. Pryor was not race-based.
Well, Your Honor, I acknowledge the fact that the record does show that there were several African Americans who were on this jury. However, at the time that this strike occurred, that was not known to the district court yet. This was the very first veneer. This was the very first panel of jurors who were being examined, and it was the first strike used by the government. That's when the Batson hearing occurred on with respect to Mr. Pryor. So I think that the fact that three African Americans eventually were impaneled on this jury carries less weight when doesn't really come to bear on this question of whether the strike of Mr. Pryor was, in fact, racially motivated. In short, I do think that the district court's conclusion that the strike of Mr. Pryor was not racially motivated was clearly erroneous, and this court should reverse. And if the court has no further questions on this issue, I'll move on to Mr. Nelson's sentencing issue. At the outset, with respect to Mr. Nelson's sentencing, I note that the government has agreed that a remand is necessary because the district court did err in assessing three criminal history points to Mr. Nelson under sections 4A1.1D and E of the sentencing guidelines. But a remand is further necessary because the district court committed an additional error, and specifically, the district court erred by relying on arrest reports in calculating a drug quantity attributable to Mr. Nelson. what happened here was when probation went to make a recommendation as to sentence, reviewing the record in the case, probation and apparently district court as well concluded that there wasn't any testimony, credible testimony in the record from which a drug quantity for Mr. Nelson could be determined. And so what they did was they went back and looked at arrest reports generated from Mr. Nelson's drug-related arrests over the course of the conspiracy, and based on those, determined drug quantity attributable to Mr. Nelson, specifically approximately 52 grams of crack cocaine and 16 grams of heroin. As the court is aware, the drug quantity finding is crucial for sentencing purposes. In particular, the distinction between crack cocaine and cocaine has significant ramifications under the sentencing guidelines. And particularly in light of the huge effect that they had here on Mr. Nelson's sentence, the evidence that was used to calculate those quantities did not have sufficient indicia of reliability. And I just want to point out for the court that in those arrest reports, there was no indication of how that quantity was determined. There was no indication of how the drug type was determined. We were dealing with a distinction, crack cocaine versus cocaine, that's not the easiest distinction in the world to make. Even experienced law enforcement officers get this wrong. And in this case, we were dealing with state police officers making these arrests. And as the government pointed out, under Illinois law, the difference between crack cocaine and cocaine there is no difference for purposes of the criminal law in Illinois. And as a result, it seems to me that state officers are much less equipped to, you know, take care in making this distinction, which, in my opinion, casts further doubt on these reports. To wrap up, I do want to be clear that I'm not arguing that under no circumstances can arrest reports ever be used. I do think that under these circumstances, where you're talking about a tricky distinction between crack cocaine and cocaine, and where there's no indication of the experience of the officers making the determination, and where they have such a huge effect on a sentence, they are just not sufficiently reliable. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, Mark Martin, I'm here for D'Angelo McMahon, who was the defendant who was acquitted of the conspiracy count. He was also acquitted of one of the telephone counts. He was convicted of one count, which was a telephone count, carried a maximum sentence of 4 years. In fact, that was the sentence he received. The count at issue was count 7. And count 7 on its face was very, very specific as to the telephone call that was at issue. The telephone call occurred on December 23rd, 2003 at 9:52 p.m. And what happens is a Tracy Butler and a Antonio McMahon, D'Angelo's brother, on the telephone. And they're talking back and forth about Tracy Butler having some marijuana. Specifically, Tracy Butler says that she has 3 pounds of marijuana available. She wanted $4,700 a pound. Antonio tries to talk her down on the price and then says, hey, Deke wants to holler at you, and Deke gets on the phone. Deke, or D'Angelo McMahon, then says that he would pick up one, meaning 1 pound of marijuana, and they talked about opening up an ugly line, whatever that means, and agreed to speak the next day. That's the telephone call. The next day, there are telephone calls in which the McMahons talk about picking up smoke, which is marijuana, and that they obtained a truck, which could reasonably infer to be a pound of marijuana. Despite the fact that we would suggest that the offense of conviction dealt with marijuana, the district court applied the stringent cocaine-based guidelines in sentencing Mr. McMahon. The base offense level for a pound of marijuana would be level 8. A base offense level for 3 pounds would be a level 10. Here, the district court found the offense level to be 34. It added 2 for obstruction for a total of 36 and imposed the maximum sentence. And if you look at the district court's findings, Judge St. Eve's focus really was on whether these cocaine-based transactions, which were alleged to have occurred the next day after the call, were proven by a preponderance of the evidence. She didn't walk through the relevant conduct factors that have been set forth in this court's cases. She found that there was sufficient evidence that the transactions were proved, and because of that, she reached her finding. If you look at the relevant conduct factors, I have to grant the government the temporal proximity factor because the conversations the judge relied upon occurred the next day. But the temporal proximity is not the end all. In Taylor, for instance, the other crime occurred with a week after the offense of conviction, and the court found that that was not sufficient. In Ritsima, which was discussed in Taylor, the other crime or the relevant conduct was contemporaneous with the offense of conviction. And the court warned of the dangers of just because the offense occurs along with it, if it's separate, it shouldn't be considered as relevant conduct. With respect to the remaining factors, those factors all weigh in Mr. McMahon's favor. With respect to the telephone conversation.
Yeah, I have much the same question for you as I had for Mr. Anderson. You're arguing this to us as if we were the district judge imposing the sentence, but we aren't. The judge has made findings adverse to your client. Why are those findings clearly erroneous?
For two reasons. One is the court didn't apply the relevant conduct factor. She focused on whether the other transaction was proved. And on review, this court has to review those factors. I'm not disputing the district court's finding for purposes of appeal that there was a cocaine-based transaction the next day. I accept that. What I'm accepting is her application of the legal factors. And if you look at the legal factors...
Whether that conduct was part of the, in the relevant conduct language, part of the same course of conduct or the same conspiracy is a question of fact. So why are the district court's conclusions in that regard clearly erroneous?
Well, there is, just because we defer to the district court doesn't mean that there's no review at all. There has to be some review.
It's for clear error. That's why I'm asking why the findings are clearly erroneous.
They're clearly erroneous because the telephone conversation had to do with marijuana. The transaction the next day had to do with cocaine. The roles of the players are different on the next day. In the telephone conversation, the McMahons are talking about purchasing marijuana, whereas the next day the discussion is about cooking marijuana. The discussion is about a Ron Rogers coming over and obtaining a split, as they call it. So there's different roles between the two offenses. The players are different. The telephone call for which Mr. McMahon was convicted was Antonio, D'Angelo, and Tracy Butler. Whereas the next day, Tracy Butler was not involved at all. It was not a part of this court's very familiar with analyzing conspiracy and schemes. And Tracy Butler wasn't involved with this relevant conduct, which increased Mr. McMahon's sentence threefold. It's not as if, usually in these relevant conduct cases, you'll see the defendant was dealing marijuana over a course of time, and the count of conviction was just one of the transactions, and there was a lot of other marijuana deals that went down. But that's not what occurred here. Here is, we have a marijuana deal that's the subject of the offense of conviction, and the relevant conduct was crack cocaine with different players. So there's a separation, as a matter of law, we would say, between the offense of conviction and the relevant conduct. I would also note that there are a lot of cases that have looked at relevant conduct. And if the standard was, in every case it's a finding of fact, and if the judge finds there's relevant conduct, the defendant loses, there's not going to be a remand for resentencing. Well, then there's been a lot of cases to the contrary, many of which we cite in our brief. With respect to the use of acquitted conduct, I would note that count one is very specific, and that's the count he was acquitted about the cocaine deal. It talks about D'Angelo and Antonio distributing 125 grams of cocaine on December 23rd. So there can be no doubt that it was acquitted conduct that was used in this case. And the issue is whether the recent changes with respect to the Sixth Amendment affect the Watts and the...
As you know, this circuit has considered that question and rejected your position. No need to re-argue it. You've preserved it for further review if need be.
And that was my point. I realize it's for the Supreme Court, but I'd ask the court to consider the Second Circuit's approach in Vaughn, which is kind of a middle ground. And in Vaughn, the court held that the district court has discretion not to consider acquitted conduct, and that's the issue I would ask the court to look at in spite of the ruling in Price and other cases. If there are no further questions, I'm done. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Donovan.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Donovan. I represent the United States. Your Honors, the judgment of the district court should be affirmed in all respects with the exception of the calculation of the criminal history of Defendant Nelson, which is set forth in the government's brief. And I'd like to turn first to the Cunningham issue. With respect to the objection that was noted by counsel in the transcript, somewhere I believe in the 400s was the citation, that was an objection to the form of the question. It didn't have anything to do with the objection that was raised in Cunningham. It certainly did not raise the Cunningham issue for the court, and therefore the government's position is that the defendants did not object to trial. In fact, the defendants...
Can you be more precise? When this pretrial motion in limine was made, what concretely were the arguments made back and forth to the district judge?
I understand that the government prevented the defendants from challenging the legality of the wire, and that is the language that is used in the government's motion. The court's order then indicated that the defendants should not challenge the legality of the wire at trial. That is an issue that they should have raised with
the...
The wiretap. I apologize,
wire
Your Honor.
Or yes, the interception
Your Honor.
Order?
The Title III interception. That is a suppression issue.
That was the only question raised at the time?
Whether the
lawfulness of the intercept order could be litigated at trial?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was the thrust of the government's motion, and by the language that is used...
I get worried by words like thrust of the government's motion. That's why I asked you to tell me what concretely were the actual arguments back and forth. To say it's the thrust of the motion suggests that there was something else being argued or decided.
No, Your Honor, it was a one-paragraph motion that the government filed that used the term legality of the Title III interception. And the court's order used the exact same term, the legality, and indicated that the defendants should raise that issue with the court rather than bringing that up in front of the jury. Your Honors, what the court, I believe the court understood, what the government understood by that motion is that suppression issues should be dealt with outside the presence of the jury, and therefore that is not a definitive ruling which covers the issues which are raised by the defendants now, specifically the bolstering of the calls or the bolstering of the government's evidence from the Title III interception. A pretrial ruling is only definitive for those subjects which it covers. And on the subject of a trap for the unwary on whom a trap was sprung in this case is the district court and the government. When the defendants have gone back through the record to try to look at something that could preserve harmless error review, in this case, plain error review should prevail because the defendants did not object. Not only did they not object, they in fact cross-examined on these very points and introduced evidence themselves on these points. Therefore, that is the appropriate standard that this court should review this issue under. And if I may turn to the substance of the issue, Your Honors, the jury never learned any facts from the affidavit. There was no inference that they could draw. The affidavit, the prior proceedings, were simply a blank page, and there was nothing for them. There was no inference for them to draw with respect to the evidence that was then presented from those Title III interceptions. The government never argued this. Inference never made any use of his testimony whatsoever, and therefore there was no miscarriage of justice here, and the government believes that this issue, the district court, while we concede that there was error and that it was plain, that there was no miscarriage of justice in the district court. With respect to the Batson issue, Your Honors, on that subject, again, the standard of review here should be for clear error, and there should be great deference to the district court's findings of fact. The race-neutral reasons that the government offered are legitimate race-neutral reasons. The government was concerned, by my count, at least six friends, voluntary associates of the stricken juror, were individuals who had serious convictions, convictions for offenses that are the subject or would become the subject of the evidence that the jury would hear eventually. And combined with the fact that the defendant lived in a geographic location that may have been near the locus of this conspiracy, gave the government concern, particularly given that this is a 15-year conspiracy of far-flung individuals. If there were the possibility that that individual lived close to that conspiracy, there's certainly the possibility that the defendant would have, potentially would have knowledge of individuals who might not even be on trial.
Member of the veneer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You said there's a chance the defendant would have knowledge. You
I mean apologize.
The member of the veneer?
That the stricken juror might have knowledge.
The trustee wasn't stricken. He must have survived.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe he did. I'm just trying to avoid using his name, Your Honor. When combined with the voluntary association with a number of individuals who were convicted of very serious crimes, the government carefully and fairly evaluated the potential bias of this juror.
Tell me about the mechanics of picking this jury. I've always been troubled by how they do things in this district compared to the enlightened way it's done in the great state of Wisconsin. But counsel, in the answer to the Batson question, said that this was the first juror in the first group or something of that nature. Now, how we did things in the district court in Wisconsin was qualify the whole pool and then peremptory challenge. After all challenges for cause were extinguished, you'd have a pool of people, 30, 40, whatever the number is, and the peremptory challenges would be exercised, and that would be it. Now, apparently there was a different system that's used here.
Correct, Your Honor, and I was not present at the district court, but from reviewing the record, it appears that there was a panel of 16 prospective jurors who were questioned, and then challenges for cause were exercised, and then peremptory challenges were exercised, and that's the
and
method.
And then if you don't have 12 after that, you have to bring in another batch and do the questioning and start all over again. And
correct, Your Honor.
Pretty goofy system, I think.
Ultimately, Your Honors, the methodology that was used by the government here, asking additional questions about the geographic location of the juror who was removed from the panel, and asking questions about the juror's arrest, which the government, or I'm sorry, which the district court did not allow additional testimony from the juror about, indicates that the government was legitimately concerned about these issues, was legitimately concerned about the potential bias of this defendant, I'm sorry, of this prospective juror. And in its ruling, the court took into account various factors, including the credibility of the prosecutors in this case, as well as this juror's responses, this prospective juror's not only geographic location and criminal history of his friends, but also the fact that this juror himself was arrested. The district court considered whether there are any similarly situated jurors who the government did not strike, did not find, and in fact there are not similarly situated jurors, even on the specific race-neutral reasons that were offered by the government. And there's no compelling case to be made that either Mr. Thompson, who was raised at the time of the Batson hearing in the district court, or Mr. Eaton, who was raised much later in the transcript as a potential similarly situated juror, neither one of them have the same concerns or raise the same concerns that Mr. Pryor raised. And in addition, with respect to the pattern of strikes, the district court properly observed that there were three African-Americans seated on the juror. For these reasons, there was no clear error here, and the government believes that the judgment should be affirmed. Turning, Your Honors, to the Bruton issue, which was raised briefly by counsel, counsel indicated a continuing objection in the transcript, and while I cannot call up the exact language of that continuing objection, my suspicion is that that was a continuing objection to introducing any of these post-arrest statements in the way that they were redacted pursuant to Bruton, not that the defendant was preserving a standing objection on the basis that is raised before this court, which is that the context or the order of proof in this case somehow caused a Bruton violation. Therefore, review here should be for plain error on each of the statements or points of objection raised in this court. The defendants failed to object at the time that the evidence was introduced. In each case, there is a significant delay, significant passage of either transcript pages, additional witnesses, or additional phone calls that were played before the defendants raised the objection. In addition, with respect to the specific objections that are raised, the comments of each of these post-arrest statements are vague. They are essentially innocuous as to the other defendants. And any of the statements that are made in those, I'm sorry, any of the individual allegations that are made, for example, Nelson's statement, "I'm moving packs for others," the entirety of the evidence as against Mr. Nelson pertained in some way to Mr. Nelson moving packs for the other defendants, specifically the McMahons. So at any point in the trial where the government introduced that evidence, if the government were to place Defendant Nelson's post-arrest statement at any point in the trial, this objection would obtain. And if it had any validity, it would swallow the rule and conspirators would not be able to be tried together. So for those reasons, unless the court has specific questions about specific statements, the government would just urge that, in fact, these were innocuous post-arrest statements as to the other defendants, and the order of proof that was offered here was simply initially a chronology of flippers, or I'm sorry, of co-defendants who were testifying against other co-defendants, providing detailed evidence. There were witnesses who had done controlled purchases of narcotics from the defendants. And then at this point in the case, the government presented the arrests and the post-arrest statements of the particular witnesses. One other issue I'd like to address, and that's with respect to Shawanda Dunbar. Shawanda Dunbar's calls, which are played after Gino's post-arrest statement, in which one of the references among the many aspects of Gino's post-arrest statement, one of the references is to something that Gino specifically did with Shawanda Dunbar. It doesn't implicate anyone else. Then there are some Shawanda Dunbar calls, and then the next thing that occurs is that the expert, Mr. Coleman, takes the stand and explicates some of those, two of those Shawanda Dunbar calls. So that the order of proof is rational and is appropriate. The government is calling its expert last and plays several calls immediately before that expert's testimony, so that those calls are fresh in the minds of the jurors when that expert explicates some of the code language that's contained, or some of the drug industry language that's contained in those calls. With respect to D'Angelo McMahon's sentence, Your Honors, Again, factual findings of the district court are reviewed for clear error. The district court held a lengthy sentencing hearing. There was plenty of argument back and forth with respect to the implications of the calls that occurred here. And contrary to what counsel has argued, the government would submit that there is much more than a temporal proximity to support the district court's conclusions here. In fact, this call occurred on one evening. It was with Antonio McMahon, Tracy Butler. It regarded marijuana. However, the next morning, on two calls between Antonio McMahon and Gino McMahon, Antonio is explaining to Gino that D'Angelo was responsible for two splits the night before. He's explaining to Gino that they cooked them up. He even talks in one of the calls about the number of grams that were yielded by the cooking of those splits. And they certainly disagree about how much cocaine was present and exactly what the numbers were. But that is evidence at the time, which is then buttressed by D'Angelo's post-arrest statement, where he admits, in fact, that he was responsible for one of those splits that's referred to on those calls. And so there is, in fact, you know, common accomplices, common purposes. This is part of the drug business that the McMahons were engaged in, distributing marijuana, distributing cocaine. This is the nature of their business. And so it is both a common scheme and plan, and it is also a similar course of conduct because it is very close in time and it's very similar. Granted, the subject matter, marijuana versus crack cocaine, are different. There's a result at sentencing that is different, but that does not change the factual determination made by the district court that this is what D'Angelo was doing that night. He's on the phone with Tracy Butler trying to start the ugly line, the marijuana line. He's taking his friend Ron Rogers over to 600 Collections, another locus of this conspiracy, in order to help him find a split, which he then gives him, and which Antonio McMahon attributes to D'Angelo in a intercepted phone call, which occurred the next morning. Finally, with respect to Defendant Nelson, the district court reasonably relied upon the arrest reports in this case, and again, the standard here is clear error. And I would note for the record that the PSR indicates that Defendant Nelson was convicted on four of the five charges that resulted from the arrest reports upon which the district court relied. The attribution of crack cocaine by police officers who arrest defendants is in fact perfectly appropriate. That's as a way of determining that in fact crack cocaine was present. Again, the district, there's nothing that has been shown to indicate that the district court should not have been able to rely upon those records, and therefore we believe that aspect of the district court's judgment should be affirmed. With respect to the 13.9 grams of crack in the Oak Park arrest, this was clearly during the conspiracy. It occurred during 2004. It occurred 6 days after there was a rip of money from Nelson, in which he then got on the phone with Antonio and was saying, hey, I'm out there every day. I'm not just a pack worker. He's describing himself as a manager of the conspiracy 6 days, I'm sorry, 4 days before the arrest in question in Oak Park. And therefore, it is clearly part of the conspiracy. The drugs were drugs that were distributed during the conspiracy, and the district court properly attributed that 13.9 grams to Defendant Nelson. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, then I'll, the government would ask
that. Very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Saltzman?
Yes.
On the Bruton issue, Judge, what I said at page 438 in taking a continuing objection is, I want a continuing objection to any discussions of the post-arrest statements. As I've stated earlier, I believe it violates the Confrontation Clause. And then after Gino's post-arrest statement, they're immediately played four telephone calls. Right after those telephone calls are played, I make an objection to them. It's the cumulative use of those phone calls. It points to my client. It's my client's conversations with Shawanda Dunbar. It's my client's communications with Larry McMahon. And that's the whole point of that. And that's why I believe, and I think the Hoover case is right on point, that we don't just have to, what Gray says is that we don't just have to look at the four corners, that everything's isolated at some point. And I think that in addition made that improper, and that was the basis. That's the basis for that argument, Judge. With respect to Cunningham, the point is, if the harmless error rule is in play, they have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that improper evidence didn't impact the case, didn't contribute to the verdict. I think, again, for the same reasons in Cunningham, I think it did.
I'm lost. Where did the reasonable doubt standard come from? That certainly isn't the plain error standard. It isn't even the harmless error standard.
No, the harmless error. I'm sorry. I misspoke. That they have to show beyond a reasonable doubt, Judge?
That's not the harmless error standard. Harmless error standard under Kodiakos and the federal rules is whether the error affected substantial rights. But let me come back to the question whether plain error or harmless error is the standard. And I asked Mr. Donovan what exactly happened in this motion in limine. And he said the only thing that was discussed, if discussed is what it could be called, is whether an argument could be made before the jury that the intercept order was improperly issued. Was there anything else covered in these pretrial proceedings?
Judge, the best of my memory, and that's all I have to rely on right now, is that they made a motion to prevent us from getting into the issues around the legality and the issues around the Title III intercept. And we agree, Judge. We didn't object to that.
The district judge's order doesn't imply that any particular bit of evidence is admissible. It just knocks out one potential objection. It doesn't knock out other objections.
Judge, I read the order as saying that it definitively says this issue is off base. And it's off, and I think it's off if it's off base to the
Cunningham has nothing to do with whether the intercept order was properly issued.
No, Judge Cunningham has to do with the bolstering, and that's the evidence that was introduced here, and the process of getting of making it legal, Judge, is what Cunningham has to do with and what the evidence here had to do with. So for that reason, we think that the harmless error standard applies. Thank you. No, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Saltzman. Anything further, Mr. Anderson? You probably have about 20 seconds.
That's correct, Your Honor. Real quickly. The government pointed out that the district court in the Batson context also considered the fact that Mr. Pryor had been arrested, but that was not one of the reasons given by the government for striking him. And that was, to the extent the district court considered that in determining whether there was pretext, that was inappropriate. Quickly about the 13.9 grams of crack, I just do want to point out that those drugs were recovered from Mr. Nelson in connection with the gun, which the district court excluded because it was too far from the locus of the conspiracy. That same rationale should have applied to the crack. That's my time's up.
Mr. Martin, anything further? You may have 30 seconds.
I would agree if we were saying that the transaction on December 24th did not occur, the clear error standard would prove to be an obstacle. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying it occurred, and what happened here is the district court did not apply the legal factors, just look to whether the transaction occurred. This court has said time and time again, just because another drug transaction shown by the record, that doesn't mean it's relevant conduct. The question is, legally, whether the two events are connected, and that's where we're saying the court's findings are deficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. And Mr. Saltzman, Mr. Anderson, we thank you very much for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.